This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
When Brian Brophon, a wealthy New York businessman, bought a farm in rural Vermont, local residents were instantly charmed by his easy manner and good-natured attempts to adopt country ways. But in 1990, an early morning raid on Brophon's farm left his friends and neighbors stunned. The congenial city slicker was apparently a major player in the international drug trade. In the summer of 1988, tensions in the Persian Gulf were at the boiling point. On July 3rd, Captain Will Rogers of the USS Vincennes, believing his ship was about to be attacked, mistakenly ordered his gunners to shoot down an Iranian airliner, leaving 290 civilians dead. Several months later in San Diego, a car bombing that is no accident. The target is the wife of the American ship's captain. In police radio code, it's known as 211 Armed, a robbery in progress. Two masked gunmen are about to terrorize the customers and employees of a restaurant, clean out the cash register, and then escape, unmolested and unidentified. Since August 23, 1991, the same scenario has unfolded no less than 29 times in and around the city of Vallejo, California. In every case, the robbers brandished handguns or semi-automatic weapons. And in almost every case, the target was a pizza restaurant.
Join me for these fascinating stories. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery. Orleans County, Vermont, lies on the United States border with Canada. Its quiet countryside is dotted with small farming towns whose families have lived here for generations. In these parts, a stranger is guaranteed to cause a stir. But no one was prepared for the whirlwind that would follow the arrival of a man named Brian Brophon. In August of 1986, the wealthy New Yorker bought a 30-acre farm in West Glover. He told people he had made his fortune manufacturing toothbrushes and had come to the country to put down roots. His unassuming manner soon won the trust of his neighbors.
He loved Vermont, and he really became friendly with a lot of the local people. He had this easy way about him that made people very comfortable.
Bye-bye, baby.
Tough to part with this one?
Nancy Buckley met Brian when he called about a puppy she advertised in the local paper.
Bye-bye.
He was open and friendly and was either knowledgeable in an area that you were interested in, or he was very curious and wanted to learn about something that you knew a lot about. And both of those things ingratiate him to you.
He was an accident waiting for a place to happen. He knew nothing about country life, but he was willing to learn. But Brian's idea of learning was to ask you to help him do something and then stand and watch you do it.
You know, I think there's something wrong with this saddle. This doesn't feel right.
Frank and Susan Medor, who also owned a farm in Virginia, were Brian's nearest neighbors. They probably knew him better than anyone in the area.
Manual labor was not in his vocabulary. But he did it in such a likable way, you didn't object to it. He was very obviously a city boy. He couldn't hide that.
I think you do that on that side.
Could you show me one more time?
Oh, sure.
Brian Brophon was definitely a hard man to figure.
He knew next to nothing about country life, yet he went out and spent thousands of dollars to buy a single horse of a special breed, a warm blood.
What a great big warm blood. He's wonderful.
Yeah.
A big horse.
Brian then paid thousands more to board the horse with another neighbor, Peggy DuPont.
There were a couple things about Brian that seemed a little strange. The first thing was that he paid in cash for his board. He had two horses, so he would pay me $500 in cash for the boarding. And my husband immediately said, oh, he's a drug dealer. And I said, he's not a drug dealer, you're out of your mind. He's a nice person. And besides, he had to go to the bank first to get the money, he told me so.
Peggy DuPont's husband had no idea how right he was. On February 12, 1990, 20 heavily armed Vermont State Police, DEA agents, and U.S. Marshals paid a visit to Brian Brophel's farm. The agents burst in on a crop of more than 2,000 marijuana plants. It was the biggest bust in Vermont history.
There you go.
At that very moment, Brophil was with the Meadors at the farm in Virginia.
Between the coffee and the cigarettes, you're gonna be dead.
At 8:30 a.m., a friend from Vermont telephoned with stunning news of the raid.
Why would they want to know if I've seen Brian? Are you kidding?
Gonna do any writing today?
I don't think so. I got all that work in the corral to finish. Tomorrow will be a better bit.
That was weird. There was a marijuana bust in West Charleston. They're looking for you, Brian. I mean, what's going on?
I don't know. Geez, I better make a phone call, huh?
He just was real calm and said,
geez,
I better make a phone call. So he went and made a quick phone call, and he came back and said, you're going to have to take me to the airport, he said, because I'm going to have to straighten this mess out.
He said that he was worried about his reputation and what is somebody trying to do to him, and this can't be right. I've got to get home and straighten out my reputation. It was at that, I mean, I sincerely believed him.
The Meadors unwittingly drove Vermont's biggest pot dealer to the airport. Brian Brophil then dropped from sight. Meanwhile, authorities were just beginning to realize the scope of his enterprise.
The agent's initial reaction was just one of pure awe. Nobody's ever seen such an operation nationwide. It was one of the most sophisticated operations that has ever been seen.
Brophil has spared no expense. His marijuana plantation featured automated irrigation and lighting. A heating system sheltered the plants from Vermont's hard winters. Authorities estimated that the operation had been grossing as much as $250,000 a month. Agent LeBeer sifted through Brophil's private papers, trying to pick up the fugitive's trail.
I was looking for anything that would tell me who Brian Brophil was, or is, or will be. I found volumes of information. I tracked down each piece of information, and each piece of information led me to a dead end.
Agent LeBeer expected Brophil would have a well-documented criminal past. However, FBI and various state records revealed only a single conviction for drunk driving. Convinced that Brophil was wanted somewhere for something, Agent LeBeer contacted Interpol, the International Law Enforcement Agency. He was stunned to discover that the giant marijuana operation was little more than a hobby, just a small part of an illicit drug empire masterminded by Brian Brophil.
What I learned is that he initially began smuggling in the late 1970s, early 1980s. He got involved with a group of people who were living a good lifestyle. He traveled to a few exotic places with these people and got addicted to their lifestyle. He wanted to become a playboy. The quickest way he could do that was to become a narcotics smuggler. Initially, Brian traveled to Southeast Asia in the South Pacific, where he procured small amounts of narcotics. He would take these narcotics and tape them to his body and walk through customs. He did this in countries that execute people for drug activity. Brian would walk through customs without sweating a bead and making friends.
By the time Brophil moved to Vermont, he had developed one of the world's largest drug smuggling networks. After months of painstaking research, Agent Labir was able to penetrate Brophil's shadowy world and recruit an informant.
Hey, what do you got for me?
All right, this is what I found out. He's working on his mother load.
His mother load?
Yeah, his mother load. He talked about this one for a while. This is the one he's going to retire on. Brings the drugs in on the West Coast.
The man's disclosures were frustratingly incomplete.
What they do is they rent the beach house.
Brophil planned to smuggle some $20 million worth of heroin into the United States, perhaps along the Oregon coast.
Then what?
But Agent Labir could never pin down the exact place or time.
I don't know what happened at the operation.
Who's working for him?
He confirmed our speculation that Brian is a major narcotics smuggler and is continuing to smuggle his narcotics. What we didn't learn is the specifics. We know that Brian's out there right now smuggling narcotics, peddling his narcotics, but we don't know exactly where he is.
When all of this happened, I was in shock, and I just couldn't believe that he could live such a double life.
I feel sorry for Brian. I feel sorry for him because his life, his total life was a lie. He lived this lie so perfectly that he obviously had no life of his own. The Brian that we liked did not exist. So I can't certainly feel sorry for him being caught.
On the night Brophil's story aired, our phone center switchboards lit up with calls from Paso Robles in Central California. Alert viewers there recognized Brian Brophil as one of their neighbors. Local authorities immediately moved in to make an arrest, but Brophil had vanished again.
Our understanding is that Brian watched the show. The show aired at 8 o'clock and Brian was gone at 8:15. He had left all his personal belongings behind and was just gone.
In Paso Robles, Brophil went by the name Brian Jenkins. He found work as a handyman at local horse ranches and became an accepted member of the community. Brophil never once drew the attention of police.
He was living comfortably with no fears. We weren't even close to him. He could have wrote a textbook on how to hide. He was that good.
But Brian Brophil wasn't good enough. After he fled Paso Robles, viewer tips helped authorities track the fugitive south to Carlsbad near San Diego, where he was arrested on December 19, 1993. 3 weeks later, Brian Brophil was extradited to Vermont. If convicted on all charges, he faces a prison term of 20 years to life. Next, a car bombing in San Diego. The suspects, international terrorists seeking revenge. Summer 1988, the Persian Gulf. Just 3 months earlier, an American ship had been badly damaged when it ran afoul of an Iranian mine. Now the Gulf swarmed with United States naval vessels and aircraft. Their mission? Protect U.S.-flagged oil tankers from increasingly hostile Iranian forces. The centerpiece of the United States naval presence in the Gulf was the USS Vincennes, a state-of-the-art guided missile cruiser, fully armed with surface-to-air missiles. What happened on July the 3rd, 1988, would claim 290 lives, alter the face of Middle Eastern politics, and deeply affect Will Rogers, captain of the USS Vincennes. By chance, a Navy film crew was aboard the ship that day. They documented the hellish events.
Started out in a benign fashion. We were en route to Bahrain to celebrate the ship's birthday. And as we had approached the southern end of the Gulf, I received a radio call that the USS Montgomery was having some difficulty with Iranian Revolutionary Guard small craft. We were directed by higher authority to develop a tactical picture and relay this information back to Bahrain.
The Vincennes dispatched a reconnaissance helicopter. It was immediately attacked by at least 7 Iranian gunboats. Captain Rogers sought and received permission to return fire.
What ensued was a rather violent surface engagement between myself, USS Montgomery, and about 7 small high-speed craft.
Almost simultaneously, an unidentified aircraft showed up on the ship's radar screen. The plane appeared to be gathering speed and descending straight toward the Vincennes.
I initially didn't pay much attention to it. It was of some interest, but not very tactically significant, particularly in the middle of this surface engagement we were involved in. We commenced to issue radio warnings, asking it to divert from its course, heading directly at us. Received no response. In the meantime, the surface engagement continued. I was very concerned about damage to my ship, injury to my crew. When the aircraft had reached 20 nautical miles, I had permission to engage it from higher authority. I simply couldn't believe that this was happening. Elected not to engage. When the aircraft had closed to about 12 nautical miles, the decision had to be made, and I chose to engage it with missiles.
The crew's jubilant mood quickly turned somber. Information began to come in over the radio about an Iranian passenger plane which had failed to show up at its appointed destination.
It became obvious to us that something was badly wrong. What the pieces of the puzzle began to add up to was this overdue airliner. Was the result of the missile engagement that we, in fact, had destroyed a civilian airliner.
President, hold the ship, crossing the Iranian-declared war zone line.
The men aboard the Vincennes had come face to face with the unspoken fear that haunts every military man. They were responsible for the death of innocent civilians. 290 passengers aboard a commercial Iranian Airlines flight were dead. Their baggage and personal effects creating an eerie wake in the blue waters of the Gulf.
Most people accepted the downing of Iranian Air Flight 655 as a tragic error. The flight was not running at a scheduled time. It had not responded to repeated requests to identify itself. And the Vincennes radar screen could not differentiate between the large passenger plane and smaller Iranian fighter jets. Inside Iran itself, however, response to the incident was quite different. One high-ranking Iranian official even stated that his country would not forgive and claim the right to revenge.
In San Diego, California, Captain Rogers' wife, Sharon, a fourth-grade school teacher, tried to cope with the news. A few weeks later, she would have chilling reason to take the Iranian rhetoric seriously.
It was about a month after July 3rd. It was 1 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang. There was a man
Hello?
On the other end of the phone with a Mideastern accent. He wanted to know if this was the home of Captain Rogers. And then he said, are you the wife of the murderer? And at that time I hung up. My worst nightmare was coming true. I had feared that there was someone out to make retribution for what had happened in the Gulf. At this point, with someone calling me, I thought possibly they know where our home is, they know where I live, and possibly someone's in the city. It didn't sound like a long-distance telephone call to me. Needless to say, I didn't sleep the rest of the night.
The Naval Investigative Service was called in to secure the Rogers home. Agents checked the mail and monitored incoming phone calls. They recommended that Sharon Rogers always keep her car securely locked in the garage when she was at home.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
10 weeks went by. No further phone threats were received. And on October 24th, 1988, Sharon Rogers was at the dock to welcome the USS Vincennes and her husband home. Despite the period of relative calm, the Rogers continued to observe safety precautions and to keep both cars garaged. Then on March 9th, 1989, their stringent attitude momentarily relaxed.
Will and I had a commitment at the Navy base for a Navy meeting. And we got back home around 9:30. We were both exhausted.
I'm really tired.
Inadvertently, I had parked my van on the driveway.
I guess it'll be all right.
To make a long story short, we were very tired. We decided not to put the cars in the garage. It was the first night since July 3rd that we had not parked the cars in the garage.
And the only night, the only time.
At 7 o'clock the next morning, Captain Rogers, as was his custom, left the house and drove his wife's van to a local market to buy breakfast pastries.
Will came back to the house. We exchanged a few words. It was time for me to go to work. Got into the van, pulled out of the driveway, took my normal route to school. Everything seemed fine. Pulled up at a red light at La Jolla Village Drive in Genesee. And it was then that I heard the explosion. I knew that if I'd ever do anything right, I'd better do this one right, because I realized I didn't have many seconds left before I could get out of that van alive.
Sharon Rogers threw open the driver's side door, but forgot that she had her seatbelt on. As she struggled to free herself, a few of her precious seconds slipped away.
I jumped from the cab of the van. Then I ran to the curb where there was a construction worker. He took me and placed me in the cab of his truck, put his jacket around me, and
are you sure you're okay?
And asked if there was anyone I wanted to call.
Can I call somebody for you?
Oh, yeah, my husband, please.
What's the number?
About that time, a policewoman approached me. I told her who I was, that I was the wife of the captain of the Vincennes. She immediately called a halt to everything and told everyone to move away, get away. She then began calling in the Naval Investigative Service, the FBI, everyone else.
At the time, I simply couldn't grasp it, could not fathom that, in fact, the van had been bombed. I was convinced that the catalytic converter had exploded. But then very shortly, I noticed laying in the street a length of pipe about like this, which is split from end to end, and that was no catalytic converter.
An FBI investigation revealed that indeed, a large pipe bomb had been strapped to the underbelly of the van.
Sharon Rogers was extremely lucky. The blast from the bomb went up just behind her seat, through the roof of the van and out to the right side of the van. The bomb was definitely designed to kill someone. It was not a prank. It was placed underneath the vehicle, located probably just behind where the driver's seat was.
The FBI learned that less than 2 months before the bombing incident, a stranger had been asking questions on the Rogers Street.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Would you happen to know which house the captain lives?
The captain? I'm sorry, I don't think I can help you with that.
I was told that a Middle Eastern family lives in this neighborhood. Would you know which house that might be?
Well, you might try the gray house on the right, the third house up. I believe there's a Middle Eastern family that lives there.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
The FBI produced this drawing of the man based on the description given by the Rogers neighbors. The man was thin, 5 feet 9.5 inches tall, with dark eyes and hair and receding hairline. He had a pronounced Middle Eastern accent. A second man waited for him in the passenger seat of a BMW with California license plates. The BMW was an unusual color known as bronzette beige. Both men appeared to be in their 30s. It should be stressed that neither man is wanted for any crime, only for questioning.
We would like to identify the two individuals who spoke to the neighbors, as that's one piece of our puzzle that we need to solve. And in addition to that, we would like anybody that has any information at all relative to the bombing or to the individuals involved in it to give us a call.
I think we both fervently hope that it results in the arrest and conviction and ultimate imprisonment of the people responsible for the attempt on Sharon's life. The FBI and the NIS have worked very hard to bring this case to a conclusion, and we certainly hope that somebody out there sees something, knows something, passes that information.
This was a case of attempted murder. It was a terrorist act, and we need to apprehend someone. They need to be convicted. As Will said, they need to be imprisoned, and we have to send a very strong message to terrorism that you're just not going to win here in the United States.
When we return, the inspiring story of a young man's second chance at life and his search for the mystery woman who saved him. Rock and roll musician John Lennon once said, "Life is what happens while you're making other plans." You're about to meet a vibrant, inspirational young man named Philip McCree. 6 years ago, Philip was a high school basketball star and a hot college prospect whose life was turned upside down in a split second. It happened on August 28, 1987, during a weekend vacation in Virginia Beach, Virginia, that went suddenly and terribly wrong.
We went to the beach a day before the softball tournament and just went down there to try to get a nice tan and check out the babes on the beach. And I dove into the water with my hands out forward, breaking the wave. And that was the last movement I had, because when I dove into the wave, I broke my neck instantly and couldn't feel anything. And I opened up my eyes underwater, and it was real dark and black, and all I heard was the ocean going, shh, shh. I didn't know why I wasn't moving. You know, in my mind, I felt like I was moving my arms and swimming, but I wasn't getting nowhere. And I just kept remembering that I was gonna go way out into the ocean. I was gonna get beaten by sharks. My life was gonna be over. My basketball career was gonna be over, because that's all I love to do is play basketball.
Just the previous season, Philip McCree had led his Newcastle, Pennsylvania high school team into the state playoffs. He seemed destined to win a college basketball scholarship. Philip's most glorious moment had come during a matchup with his team's arch rival. With a score tied and only seconds remaining in the game, Philip stole the ball.
Gaines with a jump, steal by McCree. 5 seconds. Philip, forecourt with three. Dribbles to the hoop. Good! Newcastle wins it at the buzzer. It's over. Philip McCree, it's over. Yes, it counts. Newcastle wins it.
8 months later, Philip found himself unable to move his arms and legs, buffeted by waves, not knowing whether he would live or die.
I do remember when I was underwater, I was saying, "Help, somebody help me. Help," I was screaming.
No one knows if Philip's calls for help were actually heard, but miraculously, they were answered by a woman whose identity remains a mystery to this day.
I was looking out into the water and I saw some lady pulling Philip out of the water, but the only reason I knew it was him was from his swimming trunks that he had been wearing. And when I saw the swimming trunks, I just ran.
What happened here?
Phil, I don't know. I think his body surfing. He bumped into me.
Phil!
Step back!
Can you look at your toes?
No. Move something, please.
And I heard my sister saying, Philip, move something. Move your arms. Move your legs. And I was gasping for air, and I responded by saying, I can't move anything. And that was it.
Move something, please.
Can you wiggle your feet? Can you wiggle your fingers?
No, please. What's wrong with him?
With everyone's attention on Philip, the quiet rescuer was all but forgotten. She disappeared before anyone could ask her name.
I've often thought about the woman that saved Philip. Now I regret that I didn't thank her at that time. But my mind and my thoughts were just all for Philip.
I got the telephone call from Virginia Beach. The doctor was on the phone. He says to me, Mrs. Macri, and I says, yes. He says, I need your verbal consent to do something on Philip. And I says, you have it. What'd he do, break an arm or a leg? He says, no, ma'am, he's paralyzed. Broke his neck.
When I saw my parents for the first time, it was so hard. It was like the hardest thing. Seeing them, you know, hovering over me, crying and telling me that I'd never walk again.
It was devastating all around. Maybe men aren't supposed to cry, but I cried more. I never cried so much in all my life as I did then.
For 3 days, doctors pumped sand from Philip's stomach. For 2 weeks, he was wrapped in ice blankets to counter raging fevers resulting from multiple infections. Finally, Philip's condition improved enough for doctors to surgically stabilize his crushed vertebra, but the damage had been done. More than 5 years had passed since a mysterious stranger gave Philip a second shot at life. In that time, Philip has had to redefine his aspirations, but he pursues them with the same determination he once brought to the basketball court.
When I was in the hospital in Virginia, I had like 3 or 4 goals. First goal was to get off the respirator. My second goal was to get in a wheelchair and don't be so depressed and knowing that, you know, it's all right to be in a wheelchair. And my last goal was to go to college and get a degree and get a job.
This is Philip Macri coming from the campus of Westminster College. And here are today's sports headlines. The Chicago Bears have canned coach Mike Ditka.
Philip is majoring in telecommunications at Westminster College near his home in Pennsylvania. In the fall, he will return to the sport he loves, this time as a play-by-play announcer for local high school basketball games. Philip Macri has made the most of his gift of life, but he still hopes to accomplish one very important goal. He would like to personally thank the woman who saved him.
It's very important to find this lady who pulled me out of the water because, again, I wouldn't be able to fulfill my goals of becoming a sports broadcaster. I wouldn't be able to be here with my family today. I wouldn't be able to do the things that I always wanted to do in life if she wouldn't have saved my life.
On the night of our broadcast, Philip was overjoyed to learn that he would finally get his chance to say thank you. 43-year-old Linda Potts called our telecenter and identified herself as the unknown rescuer. On March 27th, 1993, Philip and Linda met face to face for the first time since Philip nearly drowned at Virginia Beach.
Oh, how cool.
I got some roses for you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
When she pulled up in the car today when I first met her, it just gave me tingling all through my body and made me feel real good to know that I could thank her for saving my life.
I felt like I found a member of my family, a lost member of my family that I hadn't seen in 5 years.
That evening, Philip's parents hosted a dinner for family and friends in honor of the woman who saved their son's life.
I hope to keep a real close relationship with me and Mrs. Potts. I found out she's, you know, had some medical problems in her life, and, you know, if there's anything I could do to help her out with her problems, I'd love to help her out with it.
Philip Macri and Linda Potts, two strangers joined by a twist of fate.
Philip and I will remain friends for a long, long time. If there's anything I can ever do for Philip, all he has to do is pick up the phone and dial my number. I'll be there for him.
Recently, we brought you the story of Martha Doe Roberts, who was kidnapped from her home in Eads, Tennessee, on the morning of August 7th, 1992. Since our broadcast, several strange developments have surfaced in this case. Friends and relatives of Mrs. Roberts have received more than a dozen telephone calls from a man who claims to be her kidnapper. He has demanded a ransom of $185,000 and says that Doe Roberts is still alive.
She asked me
call. Melissa Lancaster received a call from the alleged kidnapper last December.
He was alive. He said he had Doe and that she was alive. And I said, well, let me speak to her. He said, no, you ask questions. You ask three questions. He turned around after each one and asked someone to answer it and turned around and gave me the correct answer.
This is an audio tape of a ransom call made on December 14, 1992. The caller always uses a fake, exaggerated Asian accent.
You listen second part riddle. Easy solve. You understand this? And what?
Voice tests indicate that the caller is a middle-aged white male. In addition, several of his calls have cast suspicion on Doe Roberts' husband.
In these phone calls, the caller was implicating Mr. Roberts as being responsible for the disappearance of his wife. The caller stated that Mr. Roberts had hired them to kidnap Doe and had not paid them the money that he owed them.
Any implications that I was involved in the kidnapping of my wife is totally untrue. And I resent it. I love my wife. We were like one. We'd been together for 44 years, and we was planning on another 44 years. It would be real nice if I could get my wife back. If the kidnapper were to see this and my wife is still alive, you let her go. And I'll send you $185,000 any way you want it. I'll do it secretly. If she's not alive and she's dead, you let me know where she's buried, and I'll give you $50,000 any way you want it.
On a previous broadcast, we presented the unsettling story of Ethel Nation, a nurse in San Antonio, Texas. During the 1950s and 60s, Nation allegedly operated a secret but lucrative enterprise in which she befriended young, unwed mothers and then sold their babies for a profit. Our segment profiled the case of Donette Barker Lucier, who was adopted in 1966 by a childless couple in San Antonio. As a last desperate attempt, they had approached Ethel Nation after years of trying to adopt through state agencies.
There were bassinets in there with children. I think there were two twin boys and myself. My parents didn't, because they didn't expect that things would happen so quickly, They just thought they were going to go to see the baby, but at that point, Mrs. Nations told my parents that they could go ahead and take me home that night.
When Dawnette turned 18, she began to search for her natural parents. She found that her mother's name was Gloria Cantu. The adoption papers had been notarized by Ethel Nation. When Dawnette met with Nation, she was coldly informed that she should abandon her search because her mother had not wanted her in the first place.
Your mother was a tramp. She didn't want you. She went there to have an abortion, but it was just too late to have one.
I don't understand what's happening.
I told you you shouldn't have
I
been
really
messing
couldn't
around
understand
with
why.
Like this. You should have left well enough alone.
Or how she could say that. It hurt.
On the night of our broadcast, several viewers called our telecenter on behalf of Dawnette's birth mother, Gloria Cantu Martinez of San Antonio, Texas. A short time later, Dawnette spoke to her mother for the very first time and learned that Gloria had never intended to give her up, but had been tricked into signing the adoption papers. Dawnette was overjoyed to discover that Gloria wanted to see her as soon as possible. On November 9th, 1992, Gloria flew to Washington, D.C. for a tearful reunion with Dawnette. For mother and daughter, it was an emotional end to 26 years of painful separation.
When I was waiting for her to come out from the plane, a million things were going through my mind. Just relief that it was over, that I was finally where I wanted to be after a long time of looking.
I just couldn't believe it. That it was finally gonna happen. What I always wanted. I've always wanted to find her and wondered what she was like, if she was married, if she had any children.
The reunion was made even more special when Gloria met her four grandchildren for the first time. Dawnette's dream of having her entire family together had finally come true.
This is Michael.
How are you?
This is Tyler.
In the past 6 months, 29 restaurants in the Vallejo, California area have been robbed at gunpoint. Authorities believe that the robberies are the work of a marauding street gang known to operate in Northern California. To date, no innocent bystanders have been seriously injured, but police fear that if the holdups continue, violence is inevitable. The assault-style robberies typically occur between 9 and 11 p.m. near closing time, when the restaurant is virtually empty and the cash register is full.
Move! Come here! Come here! Get over here! Get over here! Get on the floor! Get on the floor! Get out!
Police believe that in all, there may be as many as 6 to 8 pizza bandits who usually operate in rotating teams of two.
Just stay in front right there! Stand down! Nobody move! Nobody breathe! Shut up!
When the two robbers came in, they were just ordering us around, telling us to open things. If we weren't fast enough, they'd curse and yell and tell us to do it quicker. So we just gave them the stuff and hoped they'd hurry up and leave. From the time they came in to the time they left, it probably took about 2 minutes.
All right, man, I got it. Come on, let's go, man.
So it was frightening, the fact that, I mean, they have guns right there. They could just kill you if they wanted to.
Some of the language they've used during the commission of these has been very specific. They've used terms such as don't make this a 187, which in California is the penal code section for murder. The pattern was fairly consistent throughout in that it involved generally two black males that would enter an establishment. They always wore masks. They're generally of the knit cotton ski mask type. Weapons have varied from handguns, revolvers, semi-automatics, to more recently Uzi-type weapons. They've gone so far as to strike people on the side of the head with the handguns, kick them when they're down. Whether or not they're going to get more aggressive, We always fear that, and we don't want to encourage in giving them any opportunity to escalate that. We don't want to see anyone acting as a hero or taking them on.
I got it, man. Come on, let's go.
The robbers seem familiar with the layout of each individual target and go about their business with brisk, cold efficiency. Within minutes, the thieves have vanished, leaving police with almost no clues, only a handful of terrified victims. On January 3rd, 1992, authorities finally got a break in the Pizza Bandit case. A reputed member of the Vallejo gang was arrested moments after the robbery of a restaurant in nearby Fremont, California. The FBI has now joined in the investigation because the gang has also been linked to several bank robberies in the area. Two suspected gang members have been charged in connection with one of the bank holdups and are now in custody. Authorities believe there are at least five bandits still at large. All are thought to be black males in their 20s. All should be considered armed and dangerous. Join me next time. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery. Thank you.